Hello, welcome to Resonance FM. This is a live discussion show for enemies of good art, and today's programme is called Matricide and Culture. I'm Amber Jacobs, a feminist academic working in the Department of Psychosocial Studies at Birkbeck College, University of London, and today I'll be guest hosting this show for enemies of good art. With me in the studio are the filmmaker and artist Sarah Pusel, Alison Stone, a reader in European philosophy at Lancaster University, and Lucy Bolton, lecturer in film at Queen Mary College, University of London. So welcome to you all. First of all, I want to say a few words about this title of the show today, Matricide and Culture, to give listeners a sense of what we're going to be talking about today. Matricide, that is to say, killing mothers, the murder of the mother. That's our cheerful theme today, but let me clarify, we're not going to be talking about actual literal acts of matricide, although I suppose that might creep in. But instead, we're going to be thinking about matricide on the level of representation, on the level of the symbolic, on the level of fantasy, and on the level of discourse, narrative, and philosophy. Now, what this actually means, I hope, will become clear as our discussion progresses. The discussion about matricide is going to focus on one of the major arguments made by the contemporary French feminist philosopher and psychoanalyst, Luce Irigaray. And the argument that she makes that we're going to be thinking about today is that matricide is one of the dominant unconscious fantasies that underlies our Western contemporary cultures. Now, as we'll be hearing in a while, all of us here in the studio today have a strong connection to Irigaray's work in lots of different ways in our own research and practices. And our discussion about Irigaray's work will address this massive claim of hers made quite early on in her career and expanded on and elaborated within feminist philosophy, that the fantasy of matricide underlies and underpins Western patriarchies. Now, before we get into chatting about this, I just want to give you a brief contextualisation of Luce Irigaray so people get a sense who this philosopher is. Trained by and subsequently expelled from the Lacanian school of psychoanalysis, expelled for making a critique of the phallocentric bias of the dominant discourse of psychoanalysis, Irigaray has always been and continues to be an intellectual dissident. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so interested in her. She uses the methodology of French deconstruction and post-structuralist philosophy to reveal what she sees as the systematic repression of the feminine in Western thought. So Irigaray's work is marked by a tension between critique, description, diagnosis, and deconstruction of the dominant patriarchal order, and the more prescriptive utopian vision for a yet-to-be alternative future that doesn't yet exist. She once called herself a militant of the yet-to-be and is deeply committed to thinking through and working towards the construction of a transformed symbolic that could support what she tentatively called the yet-to-be-created female imaginaries. Now, all these jargon phrases that I'm using will hopefully become unpacked as we discuss this. But what she's really trying to do is work towards a symbolic order, a culture that could counter and subvert the masculinist bias of the culture that we currently live in. So in her extensive and voluminous works, she deconstructs Western philosophy and thought and gives us a deeply compelling and convincing account of and diagnosis of the culture that we live in, while posing, crucially, the question of what is to be done to change things. How do we dismantle the culture where the feminine, she argues, exists purely for the mirror negative of the masculine, as the repository of all that is unwanted and excluded from the hegemonic masculine subject? And how do we subvert a culture which is organised around this fantasy of matricide, which exists, she says, as the violent substratum of our symbolic order? So, we'll be hearing more about Irigaray's work in the discussion from my guests today and about their own approaches and uses of her work in a moment. But first, to launch the discussion, I want to quote from Irigaray herself. This is her. "What is now becoming most apparent," she says, "in the most everyday things and in the whole of our society and our culture is that at a primal level, they function on the basis of matricide." So note she's actually talking about everyday things here too. be good to come back to that later. So, how do fantasies of matricide impact on our discourses, narratives, and social lives? What are the meanings and effects of this matricidal culture on our lived experience and social realities? And what interventions can we make to dismantle the current matricidal socio-symbolic world? So that's the end of my little introduction. I'm now going to introduce our guests. I just was wondering, can I ask you all to talk generally first about how Irigaray features in your own work, your own practices, and if you have a particular take on this massive claim of hers about the centrality of matricide in our psyche and our culture? If we could start with you, Lucy.
Yes, thanks, Amber. Well, I mean, I come to Irigaray from a film philosophy perspective. So I was examining classical Hollywood films from the perspective of feminist film theory, and found that much of the critique of the objectification of women and the spectacle of women in classical dominant cinema, the critique of this phenomenon was really quite matched quite well by Irigaray's critique of the superficiality of the representation of women in Western patriarchy. But what I found so useful about Irigaray was that rather than stopping, as you mentioned in your introduction, rather than stopping at critique, she suggests a plethora of strategies, of things that women can do in order to bring about change, in order to do things differently. And much of the language that she uses is extremely resonant with cinematic concepts. So you mentioned the mirror. She talks about the mirrors. She talks about the speculum, the idea of an internal mirror. She talks about reflection and lenses and prisms and colours, sound, silence. All these things lend an extremely cinema-friendly sort of implications to Irigaray's work. So I've used her mainly to try and understand how certain films represent female subjectivity in richer ways, with more of a backstory, more of a history, things like that.
Right. So you're actually saying that we can use Irigaray's prescriptive work to actually produce film cinematic texts which subvert patriarchy. So you're using, you think filmmakers can actually make use of the theory?
I think so, yes. I mean, personally, I use it as an analytical framework for drawing out meaning from films, but I do think also that there is a prescriptive element to Irigaray's work that filmmakers could find a whole range of options and possibilities that they could implement and draw upon.
Thanks, and I'm sure we'll come back to that when we talk to Sarah about her films. Can I ask Alison how you come to Irigaray in your life and work?
Yeah, this isn't going to be too easy to answer because Irigaray's influence on me has been so profound. I guess beginning when I was a PhD student, I just got really interested in Irigaray's philosophy. And I would call myself an Irigarayan philosopher, so I suppose she's, you know, maybe the philosopher who's most influenced me. I don't know what from her work to pick out, really. I mean, recently I've been thinking and writing about issues to do with the maternal, and I have thought about her claims about matricide from that point of view. And I guess I would basically accept her claim about matricide being a dominant underpinning fantasy. But I remember even as a PhD student, when I mentioned this in my thesis, that my supervisor, who wasn't an Irigaray person, said, but this rhetoric is just completely hyperbolic and exaggerated. You know, he thought it was fine to say that Western society and culture have been patriarchal, but saying that it was matricidal, for him that was a step too far, which is quite interesting, I suppose.
Yeah. How do you understand her claim, actually, that we live in a culture underpinned by matricide? Because, I mean, I agree with you. I also identify as an Uruguayan philosopher, and she's certainly one of the philosophers that's inspired and politicised me as a feminist most. And the claim that matricide underscores our whole social, cultural and symbolic life, it does sound hyperbolic and grandiose, but then when you study it on different registers, you begin to see the enormity of that. And
absolutely.
I wondered, can you give any examples of the registers that you can confirm and see that the matricidal economy as manifest?
Well, I suppose most recently what's interested me is within a lot of psychoanalytic theory in the form of the idea that we need to separate from our mothers in order to become autonomous or just in order to become selves at all. Like the idea that if we can't separate, then we're just going to be stuck in some sort of selfless chaos.
Yeah.
So even something like that.
So we could see, because there is a specificity about the word matricide, isn't it? It means murder of the mother, whereas you're talking about the necessity to separate from the mother. But these things join together to kind of culminate in this idea that the mother has to be severed, rejected, psychically murdered in order for identity and differentiation and individuality to exist, so that looking back to the mother becomes this dangerous hell, like Orpheus looking back or Lot's wife looking back, getting pulled back into this regressive swamp or fusion with the mother.
Yeah.
And this is what Ira Gray is pointing to, isn't she? That this isn't a natural situation of raw empirical truth. This is an ideological situation which the patriarchal culture produces. So there's nothing inherently dangerous about mothers. It's the symbolic that is at fault.
Yeah.
So we can, for listeners, say that the relationship between things like rejection, severance, turning away from, is linked to this matricidal economy. It doesn't have to be literally notions of killing.
No, absolutely. I mean, I suppose the thought would be that from a psychoanalytic point of view, you separating yourself from your mother as a child, it's not like you're just kind of neutrally recognising a separation, that you have to create it, and this making yourself separate would involve mental, psychical violence, so that would be how separation could be construed as matricide.
Yeah. Can I ask you one more thing before we move on to Sarah?
Yeah.
Would you say then that psychoanalysis reproduces a matricidal economy?
Some of it, although it can also enable us to criticise that same economy, even within itself.
Can you be more specific? So which aspects of psychoanalysis reproduces a kind of matricidal economy, and which could be used as a more critical, politicised tool to understand it?
I suppose to me, particularly some Lacanian psychoanalysis, where you've got the idea that everyone has to separate from their mother with reference to a paternal third term, so that you have to have the father who kind of comes in to make you separate, able to speak, individuated and so on. And I suppose, on the other hand, a rigorized version of psychoanalysis would be one where you can think critically about all of this.
Yeah, because it was Kristeva who I think is a Lacanian, who actually said matricide is our vital necessity, one of the most reactionary moments that I've found in Kristeva's work.
I think Irigaray also extends, I mean, I would extend Irigaray's ideas about matricide to incorporate the presence or absence of female genealogy in the symbolic and in representation. So it's actually evidence, for example, in cinema, the absence of female backstories, female histories, things like that, the kind of denial of a female genealogy to a subject in masculine discourse.
So you would link that lack of female genealogy back to matricide?
Yes, definitely.
This is quite a good point to ask Sarah, who actually makes films.
Okay.
What she thinks, firstly, about how you've come to Irigaray, and secondly, what you think of Lucy's claim that a matricidal economy produces a tradition of cinema that writes out female genealogies between women relationships and the maternal subject.
Okay. Yeah, it's always different if you come from practice, because my mind's swimming around with what you're saying, and I've got things I'm trying to think, because there was a time when I did read quite a lot of a rigorized theory and in general French feminist theory in Kristeva, and it seemed quite abstract and divorced from the rest of my life, but I think it had a strong impact on me. And one of the things I suppose I did take from it was the importance of the female-female relation as a kind of the only way to really counter kind of patriarchal structures. And that also comes inside kind of the idea of a female gaze and the idea of a female imaginary. So thinking that the relation, I'm thinking of it in a different way to how you framed it, but the relation between women may be a different kind of relation to the relation between men, and that this actually was about something political and something wider, and that, yes, this whole thing of separation and separation from the mother and... I mean, there are things that come up if anybody's had psychotherapy. I went to a women's therapy centre. I don't know where that comes in with this, but there's... but anyway, so all of these things... Sorry, ground me back again.
No, that's fine. We were talking about trying... Lucy's sense that cinema's tradition writes out between women relations. It reminds me of something that Virginia Woolf once said in A Room of One's Own. You know, she going along the library shelves and she finds a book and she picks it out and it's by a woman and she just opens it at a random page and it says, Chloe liked Olivia. Do you remember that? In A Room of One's Own? All those years back in 1921 or something, whenever it was. And she said, this is radical. This is deeply subversive when there are two women that firstly are in relation to one another and then secondly actually like each other. Completely subverts the traditional patriarchal masculinist narrative where if there are two women, Woolf said all those years ago, they either hate each other or are competing for a man. So this
or it
idea
leads to some kind of insanity, which has also
or merge into some
and there
kind
were
of
also,
hell.
There has also been writing that I've read of Irigaray, a later period that had seemed to be, and certainly it comes from Kristeva as well, it seemed to be homophobic or seemed to be going along the lines of the actual female-female sexual relation as leading to kind of hysteria or madness, which comes out itself out of that patriarchal kind of thing. But so I'd understood something about Irigaray is kind of utopian, and I remember it being criticised a lot for those kinds of reasons, that it was not grounding itself in the traditional Juliet Mitchell or whatever it was, the feminist psychoanalysts that wanted to stay within the realm, and what she was doing, and maybe that's why practice-based people kind of quite were able to respond to something in Irigaray, was it was an imaginary, it was like a leap. Well, we can talk about this, you can talk about this, matricide. I didn't focus on the I was more looking at the leap out of it, that we need to do this by imagery, by imaginary imagery.
Well,
and there was something in there, and maybe that took me into making films that were all very visual or...
It's really interesting that you took that up in a creative way, because I had read those criticisms that you had of Irigaray, well, as being precisely criticisms, sort of saying she fails to recognise that, of course, it has to be, you have to have this paternal term as the way into language. If you've just got sort of relations amongst women, then they're bound to be just mired in imaginary, kind of not able to articulate themselves in a verbal way, and...
I think that's the sort of split between practice and theory, that the theory, the verbal language, will always kind of go back to itself and then get the kind of rational logic will always take you back. But actually the theory, and that's what Helena Zixou, I think, picks up on, the practice or the writing that's poetic, that leaps out of the kind of rational...
I think
is actually gives you that leap to find another space that is needed for a matriarchal actual utopian.
Let's talk about leaps. I mean, I don't think that Irigaray is wanting to produce a matriarchal utopia, but I think she's trying to produce a space where a yet-to-be imaginary can exist. Now, if she's utopian, it's funny that utopia seems to have got all this bad press in recent years. You know, she was attacked for being a utopianist, whereas I actually think we're living in a climate at the moment where being a utopianist is a necessity. We need to think about the new. We're forced to. In fact, the world in all sorts of ways is crumbling down before us, and so utopianism seems the only possible creative solution. So Irigaray comes by saying, I'm a militant of the yet-to-be, and how are you going to produce a different symbolic whereby patriarchy is undermined? So can you say something about how you think we're going to actually produce this female imaginary?
How to realise
utopia. How to realise it,
well,
yeah.
The first thing I would say is I think there's a huge difference between being a utopian and being a creative provocateur, which I think I would more accurately describe Irigaray as.
Yeah.
So she not only suggests strategies for operating outside of masculine discourse, such as mimesis, a kind of productive imitation of masculine discourse, but she also she suggests that as a way of creating space for women to create new representations or new concepts, new notions, and provides ideas for what those new spaces might look like, what how women might speak to each other, how women might relate with each other and with another. So she talks about gesture and silence and speech, as well as female pleasure, sexual pleasure. She uses all these kind of, all this vocabulary and all these notions to repeatedly stress the need for creative, bold thinking. Hmm. Now, that may seem extremely abstract, and that's why I've found considering Irigaray alongside
film
analysis to be so productive, because film is all about thinking of Virginia Woolf. Virginia Woolf's essay that she wrote in about 1922 on cinema talks about this leap, this bubbling cauldron, this cauldron of possibilities. Cinema fits very well with these kind of imaginative leaps, particularly the representations, because
but it often reproduces, doesn't it? I mean, mainstream cinema, you could argue, is one of the hegemonic structures that
absolutely
reproduces the fantasies of the devouring femme fatale maternal swamp.
And of course a
pathological mother-daughter relationship.
Well, Irigaray's analysis of the superficiality of the representation of women in Western patriarchal culture analyses very well the superficiality of the representation of women in the history of dominant mainstream cinema.
So have you got examples of cinema that you think we could tentatively say are part of this yet to be female imaginary, films which are subverting these so-called superficial representations of femininity?
Well, the reason why I drew on Irigaray to help me with film was because I noticed what I perceived to be a trend in film in the last 8 years or so of quite experimental film, usually by female filmmakers, that seem to be more concerned with spending time with women thinking, women exploring their bodies, their relationships, their histories, their female relationships.
Like and, what, for example?
Much of the work of Jane Campion is very interesting in this regard, but her film from 2003, In the Cut, with Meg Ryan and Mark Ruffalo, was an extremely sort of groundbreaking film in the way in which both formally and narratively it followed the trajectory of Franny, the protagonist, as she explores her own personal development in relation to her female relatives, her father, her mother, and various sexual partners. And when I say formally, I mean that the film utilises concepts of silence and pace and stillness, focus, variable focus, with different parts of the frame coming in and out of focus, to really kind of draw attention to the way in which it's creating its its characters and the way in which it's creating its narrative, but also to show that you can't take anything for granted.
So
it really breaks down. You know, it looks very much like generic slasher thrillers like from the 70s, like Clute or Looking for Mr. Goodbar, but in a very, I would say, Irigaray-ian way, it imitates those films but creates spaces in which Campion and the cinematographer and the performer can do things differently from a far more feminine perspective.
So in some way what you're saying is that to intervene into the symbolic in the way that Irigaray is asking for us in cinema, one has to be quite cunning. You have to use, in a way, you have to use the apparatus that exists in order to get your film made, you know, and then but you have to somehow subvert those structures to produce spaces where something else can happen.
Well, I'm not sure if you have to. I mean, certainly in the avant-garde cinema tradition and experimental filmmaking, there's you know, many examples of film that start from their own perspective, something like Sally Potter's Gold Diggers or Thriller or something like that, that really operates from a feminist standpoint and disregards many of those rules.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is films such as In the Cut, Lost in Translation, perhaps Marie Antoinette by Sofia Coppola, Lynn Ramsey's Morven Callor, these films seem to be working with fairly mainstream markers, you know, either with stars or narratives or generic conventions, but they do things differently. And I would suggest they do things differently by overdoing certain aspects.
Right, by hyperbole.
As Sarah Cooper says, that Irigaray-ian mimesis undoes by overdoing.
Right.
You imitate it, but it has to be a knowing, exaggerated imitation in order to have effect. And I would say that some of these films are doing that now.
So in the mainstream, mimicry is the methodology, whereas Sarah, you're working much more in, well, I hope I'm right in representing your films as being more avant-garde, experimental, and kind of in the art world rather than the cinematic, or crossing over those two.
Yes.
So in a way, maybe mimicry, blowing up things, but trying to stay within the structure of the mainstream while opening up space to produce something different, is more to do with people in the mainstream cinema. Whereas, do you think you can start off from a different premise completely in your work? You
know? Well, I have done.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder whether when you say extreme, it kind of means like that taking something to excess where you make it conscious. But I don't know if you mean that, where you do something that is problematic, but it's made conscious, so therefore it's not invisible and therefore it's not repressed.
Well, let me give you an example. Yes, there's a scene in The Cut where the protagonist, Franny, finds her sister's body murdered. Now, in the films that it echoes in terms of genre, there's normally a shot of a mutilated body and then a cutaway to see the body being removed in fairly long shot, or at least medium shot. In The Cut, Franny enters the bathroom and finds her sister's head in the sink, picks up the head, holds it, cuddles it and nurtures it, and sits on the floor hugging it. And you see the features of poor Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's playing the head. And it, you know, that's been described as sort of emphasising the fact that this is the person who's been killed rather than just the female slashed-up body of a slasher film.
Yeah, that's actually really amazing.
And it stresses that the monstrosity, as Sue Gillett says, that the monstrosity is with the beheader rather than the beheaded.
Yeah, and also it's just not that normal passive female dead body that grounds every horror film.
The body's not there, in fact. It's just the head
that's
her face.
Yeah.
So a moment like that, which I'm sure Irigaray wouldn't like very much at all, but it's one of those moments where it's imitating the genre but overdoing it in order to make a sort of very feminist point, I think.
That's interesting. Alison, can I ask you what you think of the effects of matricidal economy that Irigaray describes on women, whether you think that her idea of ontological dereliction, you know, that women are abandoned in an economy with absolutely no images or representations or symbolic support, that do you have any idea, what do you think about the actual effects on people's lived experience? Or not just lived experience, but on any register, you know, this idea of ontological dereliction, that the effect that it has on us women to live in the culture that she diagnoses.
I don't know. To me, at those points in her work, it's everything seems too bleak, really. You know, I don't think that there's such a complete absence of representations or expressions as at those times her work would seem to suggest.
Right.
Yeah, so sometimes I feel that she kind of does portray things as being worse than they are.
Right. So you think that actually that we're not living in such an extreme situation where there is no subject position for women that is just, or the only position offerable is to mirror the masculine?
I don't really, or I think, you know, you can say that there are certain dominant structures that would be pushing us in a certain direction, but I think that we're bound to try to resist it. You know, you're bound to have female filmmakers who will be in different ways trying to subvert this.
Yeah, and although I most think filmmakers that are actually shown in the Odeon are hardly
yes.
Irigaray subverters that's, showing a mother-daughter relationship. But Sarah, can you talk about the film that you made with your mother? Do you feel that was an intervention in trying to produce a different kind of representation?
I was only saying that because I was going to come back. Yeah, obviously, I come from a perspective, my filmmaking, which comes from a kind of feminist place that does believe that you need to kind of intervene with the whole structure. You couldn't just take it. Not that that was necessarily an option that I understood there, but that was the kind of culturing teaching that I kind of come from, that the only way of a sort of avant-garde film practice where not just feminists but all other things that one needs to kind of move out of the dominant, you need to work from another structural basis of how you make films, rather than going with an industry that is very, has its conventional tropes and ways of doing something, and it's about finance and it's about economy, and it's not actually about reinventing politics or reinventing necessarily being creative.
Ted, do you want to tell me about the film that you made with your mother?
Yeah, so the film that I made with my mother, it's a film where I film my mother, my mother films me. I tried, we hold up mirrors to each other. I tried to find, it was kind of something I wanted to do about the relationship with my mother, but I wanted that to be in a universal sense, so I always introduce it by saying this isn't about me and my mother, even though it will get kind of end up, people start talking to me about my relationship with my mother, but it's kind of wasn't, that was not. I wanted to bring, talking about the idea of the finding other ways to make films, I'm using large 60mm cameras that kind of come out of an industry. I'm also using it at a time period where it's kind of defunct 16mm. But the idea was to, whereas of course in mainstream filmmaking the crew are separated from the people in front of the camera, all of these things, everybody has a professional role. People aren't friends or family. So I sort of at one level I'm working with it. It's not a video camera, so it did involve quite a lot of technical expertise to do it. But I sort of had this idea about the mother as being hidden in the same way as the camera person or the crew being hidden. So all of that is kind of exposed and brought into the film.
So the process is made visible.
The process is made visible. Maybe there's a connection about this link from philosophy or Irigaray about what I was trying to do was to close a gap so that you don't have a separation between behind the camera and in front of the camera.
Right.
The person behind, the person in front.
Like subject, object.
Even the space behind. But to actually find a point where rather than being a binary, there's a point where they meet and sit. Mm. So I am both behind and in front. I move between those poles in the film, as does my mother. You see on camera us pass the camera to each other. You see us hold the mirrors, and we're using the mirrors as cameras. We move around the room. There's a sort of thing going on of image and word, which are both being recorded separately. So it's about trying to close.
Alison.
Mm. It sounds a bit like you're trying to avoid sort of using your mother as the background that's made all of this possible, and instead you want to make visible her role and her importance, you know, whereas normally it's like we would just draw upon everything that our mothers have done for us in this unthinking way.
Yeah, I guess I was just making some relation. There are lots of different relations of the mother that's hidden in the same way as the process of filmmaking normally being hidden, not just the camera.
And I think this is potentially, well, it sounds an extremely Irigaray piece of filmmaking, and I'll say why. Irigaray actually addresses this very point in dialogue with Caroline Bainbridge, where the issue is how to represent mothers and daughters how to represent mothers and daughters on film, rather than just the suggestion is, well, we can have more scenes in films with mothers and daughters. And Urigaray says, no, that's not enough. We need to rethink a way of making films, rethink a way of doing films. If we just feature more mothers and daughters in mainstream cinema, aren't we just, I think the phrase she uses is, finding another room in our father's house? Mm. And what one of the things that Urigaray yearns for, calls for, is a way for women and mothers and daughters to relate to each other in a process of exchange, mediated through some kind of object, because Urigaray would say that the women and their mothers have no real resources with which to mediate their relationship.
Because of the symbolic order that we live
because
in.
Because of the symbolic order that we live in.
Sequesters that relationship to the outside.
So the very idea, what you're doing there, it seems to me, is not only calling into question the cinematic apparatus of the gaze, you know, the director, the spectator, the director, the object on screen, but you're also, through the very fact that it's with your mother, and that you're alternating, you're attending to the modes of production and content also.
Absolutely.
In a way that is truly sort of suggestive of Urigarayan principles.
Right. I would have thought it would still
I mean,
be
that's interesting
good.
You said about the mediation.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I would have thought it would still be good to have more representations of mothers and daughters just on the level of their bare presence together, though. I find it...
Well, I mean, maybe it's a matter of both. I mean, the problem is when you think of some recent representations of mothers and daughters. Not, I'm just thinking of like the recent film Black Swan, plus also something like Haneke's Piano Teacher, where you see a profoundly pathological, psychotic mother-daughter relationship, which is just, you know, it's representing mothers and daughters, but purely in terms of what you were talking about before, the Lacanian Christavian sense that merging and fusing with the mother is some kind of catastrophic psychic
hell.
Yeah, what
I've really noticed, I'm a bit of an avid viewer of TV crime dramas, and so often there will be a pathological mother-daughter relationship.
So often.
Like, if they feature in these things at all, that is, it will be that they're, you know, fused together and caught up in doing the crime together. Or because
And also in fairy tale, right at the origins of our symbolic order, in Greek myth, in fairy tale, in fiction, in children's literature, it's often, once upon a time, there was a family and the mother had died.
Yes.
And it's
the
almost
evil
like
stepmother.
It's either the evil stepmother takes over from the nice dead mother, as in something like Snow White or Hansel and Gretel.
Poor father is bullied. Cinderella.
But even in contemporary children's fiction, that often I'll be reading a story to my kids, and it will be, you know, you'll have to edit it because you'll be reading, and the mother died, and I'll sort of say, and the mother went away on a trip, because it seems like matricide in fiction, even in contemporary children's fiction, seems to be a kind of necessity to spur the narrative. And often it's to do with orphans. The mum and the dad get killed so that the narrative can start. Mm. But more often, it's the matricidal economy sets the narrative going.
Also in the serial killer, serial killer films, it's of the sort of male serial killer killing women, it's nearly always traced back to dysfunctional relationship with the mother.
Right.
So
from
Psycho to Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer to, you know, it's always some kind of dysfunction, something to do with the domineering mother.
I find Psycho interesting because I don't know if it's meant to be an ironic comment on this very psychoanalytic view that you have to separate. Because he has failed to separate, hasn't he, from his mother mentally, which is why he's had to kill her in actuality. Yeah. Mm. But then he's still merged with her mentally, which is why sort of she's kind of taken him over from within, hasn't she? And so he's got to kill all these others.
But that's a film like some of, you know, from that era, and also other Hitchcock films like Marnie that end with a very pat psychoanalytic explanation that is clearly wholly inadequate for the what's gone on
it's like
in
the
Deus 2 hours before.
Ex machina, isn't it? Bring it in, resolve everything.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to have a break now and come back with more juicy discussions about killing mothers.
Congratulations. Congratulations, you've got the job. 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 Got the job.
We're back now. This is Enemies of Good Art, and we're talking about matricide and culture. That music, by the way, was The Job by Dub Squad from a cassette-only release from 1984 called The Art of the Unemployed on the Bop a Dub label. Thanks. So, back to matricide. Now, I thought to open up the second bit of the discussion, I might quote Ira Gray again. And this is her. The imaginary and the symbolic of interuterine life and of the first bodily encounter with the mother. Where are we to find them? In what darkness, what madness have they been abandoned? So if we could talk back again, this idea of the mad, dark place that Ira Gray thinks the maternal is placed in our current culture. Lucy, I wondered if you thought that you could understand that quote in terms of the recent, or well, the long charge that Ira Gray has had against her of being an essentialist. And also well, to maybe say something about what an essentialist is.
Yes, well, yeah. I mean, a lot of the language that Ira Gray uses, you know, she draws on female morphology, the female body, a great deal. Her first work, her doctoral thesis, for which she was expelled, was called The Speculum of the Other Woman. And it was the idea of, as opposed to the flat reflective mirror proposed by Lacan in his mirror stage about subject formation, Ira Gray said that that flat reflective mirror was inadequate for women to succeed to sort of full subjectivity, and that a speculum, an invasive or you know a probing mirror would be more suitable. Now, that can be understood in all sorts of ways, but of course the language of the speculum invites the kind of medical clinical discourse of gynecological examination, and much of Ira Gray's work is focused on discussing the two lips, the labial lips, as opposed to the singular unity of the phallus, or and this quote that you have just read out about the intrauterine places. Now, this language, I propose, is used in a very provocative way in order to call attention to the magnitude of the problem that she's analysing. She's basically saying, just imagine if we thought about things in this way. Just imagine if we conceived of the language and life and society in a dual way, a culture of two rather than a culture of one. However, that language opens her out to charges of essentialism, which are repeated and long-standing, as you say. And they really are concerned to say that she is believes she's a theorist of sexual difference. She locates sexual difference in biology. She is concerned to sort of explain or uncover what is the essence of woman, the essence of femininity. And of course that's very objectionable to many people who say there isn't actually anything essentially feminine or essentially womanhood.
And also she's a post-Lacanian. She was trained by Lacan. So in a way, I've always found the idea that she's harking back to a premeditated sort of biological femininity completely wrong, because she's taking her point of departure from the symbolic.
Yes, but what's also referred to in that quote that you read out is the most important part of this language, which is the relation between the newly born infant and the mother who has given birth. Yeah. And she locates that as the site of difference, that one is a woman giving birth to a creature of the same sex, a human of the same sex, and the other is a human of the opposite sex. And she locates that relation in difference as the foundation of the as unrepresented, the way you know that's the location of difference. Now that is clearly biological, and that is but I would still maintain that, although clearly open to allegations of essentialism, many of the terms that she uses are designed as I say, a provocative alternative way of speaking and conceiving of things, to just to try and challenge and stir you up. She says to jam the theoretical machinery, to get you thinking.
And to also use those bodily terms in a kind of ironic way,
like
as well.
Like virginity.
I find it important at times to say that she is an essentialist, at least in the sense that I think she does want to give expression to our bodies as female bodies, and she does think that female embodiment is distinctive.
Yes.
I mean, that's different from the biological. Mm. I would say it's possible to be concerned about the expression of female bodies without having to understand the body as biological.
I think that's a good point, yes, and in the symbolic, definitely. But she is keen to move away from women being reduced to their reproductive capabilities and
absolutely.
Things like that.
And
she doesn't want that.
What I've understood is that what she's saying is that within Plato, Freudian psychoanalysis, there is a body there, and it's a male body.
Yes.
And that's really what she's trying to... That's what I've understood against these attacks of essentialism, which is that a woman's mind is affected by her body and her mind is different.
Yes,
I think that's the kind of attack
the male
on essentialists.
Philosophers' minds have always been affected by their bodies.
But she's
as well.
Just saying, or the knowledge that we all have in philosophy privileges a masculine morphology, and that she's wanting to put in something about difference.
Yeah.
But of course, another allegation that's made against the Rigorai frequently is that she's only concerned with very sort of simple binaristic sexual difference, male and female. So it fails to take account of issues of race, issues of different types of sexuality, different types of personhood, and things like that. And consequently.
What do you think of that charge, actually? Because it's a serious charge.
It's
kind of a massive lacking, actually, in her philosophy.
Because there was a point not so long ago where she said that the problem of race is a secondary problem.
Yeah. Mm. But she calls sexual difference the question of our time, doesn't she? It's like that that's completely what she's seeing the problem in terms of.
For Irigaray, sexual difference is the first thing that we haven't even got that right. So she sees as any other question of difference as secondary. That is clearly... A very arguable position to take, because it's assuming that sexual difference is unraced or it's a clear cut issue, and of course it's not. So it is a serious charge, and I think there's something to it. I think it's not straightforward to say that Irigaray's consideration of difference and the culture of two can translate to other types of difference. I don't think it does work like that.
But it's also like attacking someone for not doing everything. And in some ways, what we need to do is be able to bring Irigaray to philosophy, feminist theory and politics that does include the question of race as central.
Yeah.
But to kind of attack Irigaray for not doing everything does seem to be kind of counterproductive, whereas we do need to notice strongly and intervene in that lack, but bring Irigaray in conversation with philosophies, transformative philosophies that want to accommodate difference in a much more diverse, heterogeneous, complicated way, perhaps.
And there's quite a body of work on Irigaray race as well.
Yeah, there is. It's really beginning to generate. So it's not as if Irigaray closes down questions of race.
No.
Absolutely not. It's just that she hasn't come to it herself, but perhaps, or certainly in the mainstream work.
Could I come back to a question? When you asked me earlier about what do you think are some of the effects on lived experience of this
matricidal
culture.
Economy. Yeah.
Because since you asked me that, I was thinking about this. I think that there are all sorts of manifestations around motherhood of this, because I think that certainly for lots of people, becoming a mother kind of returns you to all sorts of issues about your own mother. And this may be just me, but I have this idea that these sort of passions about the mother that are difficult to articulate are partly behind all this huge amount of argument and stuff that we have about mothering and about the right way to mother, the right way to parent.
Right.
When you have all these websites like Mumsnet and so on, where people will get so unbelievably heated and vitriolic about whether a baby should be given bananas at 6 months or 8 months or whatever.
Yeah.
I have this feeling that behind it, there's these sort of passions that have been kind of reanimated about mothers' own mothers.
Well,
it's very difficult.
If women are to blame for everything, then they want to get it right, don't they, really?
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. That I think people are kind of trying to correct what they see as the deficiencies of their own mothers, mm. because we have all this mother blaming. You know,
well, also, and it's maybe because the matricidal culture produces a situation where the maternal on a lived level is either wildly idealised or massively denigrated. So you're either blamed or you're the Madonna. And so living in that kind of dichotomy and binary produces kind of paranoia and mental health problems, actually, because
yes.
there's no subject position whereby one can just have a more measured relationship to whether your child has bananas or mm. apples. Sometimes it seems as though it's a life and death at stake. Something's at stake in that, which, like you say, it must be a displacement from something
yes.
more structural to do with the economy that we live in.
This yeah. again comes back to the images that we have, isn't it? The images that are available, the representations that are available of understandable work through recognised, fully fledged relations between mothers and daughters, or just images of motherhood in society.
But do you think that the images and the representations are the thing that need to come first to then make the actual mother and daughter relationship change? Like, how do you affect change? This is Irigoye's crucial question. Mm. Are we, in one of her books, she says, rather naively but also quite amazingly, she says, go and put up pictures in your local post office of mothers and daughters. And
yes.
I thought to myself, wow, shall I actually do that? And it did
yeah.
seem quite a daily subversion, actually, to go and put up a picture
yes.
of a mother and daughter in a post office.
But there's more to it than
that. Is that what we need to do?
Because yeah, what she says around that same passage is to put up pictures, rather than, say, if you're a Christian, to put up pictures of Mary and Anne, her mother,
yeah.
rather than Mary and Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is,
to do with the divine,
at one level it sounds rather silly and simplistic, but at another level that is a prime example of Irigoye suggesting an image-based piece of subversive action
yeah.
that intervenes in the foundations of Western Christian
Absolutely.
Theology.
And also she's appealing to us needing a symbolic level of the
That's
divine,
yes.
of a mother-daughter.
Yeah. That's yeah. in the absence of women having a divine other
yeah.
who they can see as
yeah.
sort of vertically transcendent to
yeah.
them, then, you know, work with what you've got. That's a way of saying
yeah.
a way of saying that.
So there's this
kind of rather humorous, practical side to Irigoye. In
mm.
some of her later work, she actually talks about how to arrange your home and to use cushions and fuse futons.
I just want to say, I know that I've understood that some of her recent writing has become a bit religious, and one of the things that attracted
yeah.
me to her writing early...
Spiritual, not religious.
Spiritual.
Yeah, she's
okay.
become...
What it attracted was this potential for... She didn't necessarily say overtly lesbian, but it seemed like a potential for either female-female relation, but really kind of valuing that what potentially was a lesbian relationship. Some of the... imagery, the bodily imagery, you said the lips almost sounded like a kind of lesbian seduction, even in a way. And yet later it becomes quite phobic when it actually comes to that female-female
yeah, really
relation. I'm almost thinking then it seemed to become a sort of celebration of heterosexuality,
Absolutely.
Certain points and
yeah.
spirituality. So even when you're mentioning the Christian, so
yeah.
I'm sort of thinking what you're saying, does she go back on herself on that?
Well, certainly
actually,
she's a provocateur and she's an intellectual dissident, and she's surprises us all the time in a way.
And
well, I'm saying it's regressive and conservative, some aspects
yeah.
that she's taking and reproducing.
She would say
yeah.
that she's become focused on how you can have a dialogue between men and women. But this is from the starting point that she thinks there's a radical otherness between them. So I think she would want to say it's not meant to be about glorifying heterosexuality.
No.
But I think that it is, in
and
fact,
if you have read
times.
Something that seemed to be... the female-female lesbian relationship as kind of bordering insanity. Or I can't remember what it was.
Which is reproducing
a
very pathologizing.
Although she also says that could be a place to start. She has she also does say, I'm not talking necessarily about sexual love between women, but that could be a place to start. Okay. And she also says, I'm not necessarily talking about women withdrawing from society, but that could be a place to start.
And I suppose, because we've only got a few minutes left, just to say that in a way, with these thinkers, like Freud, for example, which Freud are we choosing? The very conservative, reactionary, sexist Freud, or the massively radical, contemporary, queer Freud? You know, with these big thinkers, I think that you can choose what you take. And Irigaray is somebody who can be different for who uses her. Do you see what I mean? So she can be, like you say, Sarah, regressive and heterosexist. She can be radically queer. She can be politicised and galvanising. And in a way, it's that is so rich in her work, and also this notion of being able to diagnose and deconstruct and prescribe in a quite manifesto-y type voice. Mm. So, I mean, I think we've had a really excellent discussion about matricide and culture and Irigaray. I'd like to thank Lucy Bolton, Alison Stone, Sarah Pusel, and I want to also say that Enemies of Good Art will be back next week at the same time. Anna Shorter then will be asking artists in Berlin how they combine family life and an international art career, where commissions and residencies often take them away from home. So that's next week on Enemies of Good Art. I hope you've enjoyed the Matricide Show and that you'll go and do a Tayleigh subversion and put up pictures of mothers and daughters in your public places. On that note, thank you and goodbye.